Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Bruce Erickson, Managing Partner of the San Francisco office of Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman and the Commonwealth Club's quarterly chair. I'd also like to welcome our radio audience and remind everyone that you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, former San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown. Mr. Brown will be giving his annual Commonwealth Club lecture on the state of politics and political trends. Our former mayor, of course, needs no introduction. His career is the stuff of legend. But I would like to put in a word for his new book, Basic Brown, My Life in Our Times. I bought this myself. In it, the mayor tells the story of his miraculous rise from shining shoes in the segregated South to Speaker of the Assembly and then to mayor of the city and county of San Francisco. Now, that much you'd expect in a book of this sort. But what do you really look for when picking up an autobiography? If you have even an ounce of ambition, you look for the tips and the clues. You ask, how did this person climb up the greasy pole, to use Benjamin Disraeli's phrase, and how might I do likewise? Well, if this plus a good read is what you want, Basic Brown is the book for you. This book is chock full of advice, right down to the sartorial. Having read the book, it is no accident that I am not wearing a polka dot tie tonight, even though I own plenty of them. To find out why, you'll just have to get the book for yourself. And now let me give you one piece of advice, or two really. Enjoy the speech and buy the book. Both ways, you're in for a treat. And now, please join me in welcoming the Honorable Willie Brown.
Good evening to each and every one of you and to the regular members of the Commonwealth Club and to those of you who've come tonight for whatever reason. I am delighted to see so many of you. This is more than I've ever seen. What did you tell them? What was advertised? What am I going to do? This is incredible. The entire room is filled. I am not Al Gore, so I don't know why you're here. The whole business of having the opportunity in the Commonwealth Club to come before you is a very, very good one. Many of my colleagues in the world of politics are indeed envious. And tonight I come both as a formal politician and as an author. And I'm sure that some of you are wondering about the book. Yes, I did do a book. No, I did not tell everything in the book. There are some items of which the statutes are still open on that, and there are some people I'd like to talk about who have not yet died. So the book is somewhat limited in some aspects of it. And I still have, as a politician, my genetic structure prohibits me from being totally candid. And so as a result of that, I still suffer from that liability. But having said that, the book is pretty good. In spite of those warnings and those instructions, I must tell you that doing this book was a fun endeavor because it was a book not done the way people do books. I didn't sit down and write and run out of energy and go do something else and come back and write again. No, I didn't do any of that. My book, if you read Tuesdays with Maury, some of you may have read that book a few years ago, and you know that that book was a dialogue between Maury and another person, and that person kind of recorded his occasions with Maury, and it ended up being a fairly interesting little book. Well, my book is kind of done the same way. I'm not Maury. And I haven't died, so you don't have to worry about that component of the book. I dialogued for this book with a reporter and a columnist for one of San Francisco's newspapers, The Examiner. And we really had a lot of fun because, you see, it was maybe 25, 27 years ago, friends of mine came to me and offered to do a grant for Bancroft Library Oral History. And I sat down and agreed to do that, and John DeLuca put the money together to produce it. And we really did do an oral history for the Bancroft Library. It took about 2 or 3 years. Every Saturday, I would meet with this person from the Bancroft Library who would record and allegedly record everything that I said. Well, I got sick of her, she got sick of me, and so we ended it before we completed it. But it was the foundation for the first opportunity, really, to do a real book. And then when I left City Hall, Simon & Schuster came along with a lot of money, literally. So you can buy the book. It doesn't matter to me. I already been paid. So you can buy the book. I'm not hustling sales on the books for my benefit. Yes, my contract says that there are royalties to be had. But as one of the accountants that Simon & Schuster said to me, that he had formerly worked in the movie industry, and he wanted me to know that he was assured before he left there about a year ago that Gone with the Wind was going to break even soon. That was an indication that I can forget it, my royalties, because the bookkeeping is done the same way. But it's worth buying. It's a very nice, it's a book. It's a good book. It's a fun book. And it's a book that is reflective of the dialogue. Some of the things in the book, I wish I'd had greater editorial control and restraint, because it really displays a side of me that I didn't really know existed. I didn't know I had such a massive ego until I read this book. I read this book, and God, I am really proud of myself, as evidenced by the contents of the book. But other than that aside, read it. It has some good stories in it, good experiences, and it is not a book where you even find out that I was born until about the 90th page, the 80th, the 90th. I just don't talk about that. That wasn't significant in my life. And so, not from a recording standpoint, I didn't have any plans at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years of age for the book. So there was no reason to put that in the book early. It was not that significant. The book moves through more than 40 years of my involvement in the world of politics in California, public policy making, and it does so in a way different from normal books done by people like Bill Clinton and others. I looked at a number of those authors' books, and they were so dull. They were so uninteresting. I think I may have gotten to page 5 at the most in any of those books before I threw them down, not to ever be picked up again, even though they've been personally autographed. And I know other people must have had the same attitude, because I put one or two of them on eBay and got no takers. And so I'm stuck with these damn books written by people about themselves. Well, I decided that's not the kind of book I want to do. I really want to do a book that kind of walks you through my life and my life participating in public policy making, and do so through experiences, do so through incidents, do so through occasions, and in some, they're probably highlights. So please enjoy the book. Now tonight, I want to spend just a little bit of time talking about the world of what's happening politically today. I ended up last night being obligated from 8 to midnight, because some mayor in Gary, Indiana, decided not to allow the votes to be counted that had been cast in Gary until 11 o'clock at night. Now, the assumption is that the polls close at 8, you ought to start counting the votes. And if you delay the vote count, you know damn well that somebody is motivated to be doing something to those votes of those ballots while waiting. It's like, and Gary is close to Chicago, and you know that there obviously are some previous relationships with ballot boxes. And those of us who were on the air trying to broadcast and pontificate and project about what was going on what would happen if this happened and that happened, we were literally just stretching and stretching and stretching and stretching. And I began to recognize how ill-equipped most of those of us who are on radio, on television, really are. Beyond the stated script, beyond what we said we were going to talk about, we are at a loss if we go beyond that. And to have to go 4 hours, as was the case last night, you're talking about loss. Three or four of the people have not been located since last night. They were so lost in their presentation. And it got confrontational because I really tire quickly of people who are saying things that are coming from a lunatic's mind, an uninformed person's mind. And last night, two or three times, top flight, well-rated, early Sunday morning talk show people had no clue what they were talking about, and I told them. And the network didn't like that too much. These are their superstars, and here this cat out here from, you know, I'm the only cat west of the Mississippi. There's nobody else on the tube west of the Mississippi on this election process, and here I am telling them, you guys have no idea what you're talking about. Where are you coming from? Why do you think that would be logical at all in the world of politics? Well, they didn't like that at all, but it made for great theater. It made for really great theater, and so the management called the day and said, you were terrific. Are you available? And they obviously sent others to follow me because all day long the cameras around San Francisco have been peppering me with questions, and I know they're going to get tired of me too because their questions are beginning to get, you know, tired. They have a list that they want to talk about instead of coming to me conversationally, which is the way I did the book, and let's just talk. And that's what I'm going to do tonight with you. I know it's on your mind. Is it Obama or is it Clinton? At what point should Clinton drop out? Well, you know, that's what I did when I went to the 49ers football game. I said they ought to quit in the third quarter. They're performing so poorly. But they never did. They always played four full quarters, even though they were losing 80 to nothing. They played four full quarters. Now I know where Clinton got the idea. From the San Francisco 49ers football team, apparently. They were hoping for a miracle, I think, and I think maybe Hillary might be ultimately in the same position, because except the situation has altered itself. This is, frankly, the first year that we have really had significant change in the electoral process involving selecting candidates. It started in 1964 when Fannie Lou Hamer and a group of ragtag black Democrats showed up at the convention in Atlantic City and absolutely insisted that they were the legitimate Democratic Party. They were the Freedom Democratic Party of Mississippi, and that, in fact, they had been denied the opportunity with all the restrictions on voting in Mississippi. The Democratic Party responded, and the regular Democrats in Louisiana, in Mississippi, got the message. Fannie Lou Hamer and some of her people were seated. It then reached even greater into the whole and the souls of what's happening in the South with reference to the political process and with reference to voting, when in Chicago we kicked Lester Maddox out of the convention and we seated Julian Bond and his delegation at that convention in Chicago. Some other things occurred in Chicago. Nobody's written about that part of it, and they've read about everything else. Tom Hayden and all Jerry Rubin and all those people write about what they did in Chicago. But the real significance was when the Democratic Party said to an organized group of discriminatory Democrats out of Georgia, you are not a legitimate representation of the Democratic Party of Georgia. You are out of here. We're seating Julian Bond. And then in 1972, when George McGovern was prospectively the nominee, the same kind of people that are talking now, these Democrats leaders, were lamenting over the fact that George McGovern probably would lose. Well, obviously, he did lose. They were right in that he would probably lose. But nevertheless, under the process, George McGovern was entitled to the nomination. If they didn't want George McGovern to have the nomination, they never should have set the rules the way they set the rules. Because they said, if you are in a particular state and you win the popular vote by one, you get all the delegates. And that's when I did the speech, give me back my delegation, because they tried to change the rules on the floor of the Democratic Convention. Well, we succeeded. All the delegates from California were under the leadership of John Burton, Dolores Herter, and Willie Brown, and we won the nomination for George McGovern. Fast forward. The fathers of the Democratic Party, the mothers of the Democratic Party, lamented over the fact that this ragtag group of Democrats who managed to do grassroots work beat the machine run on behalf of Hubert Humphrey for the nomination. They said, we're never going to allow that to happen again. We're going to figure out how to make sure Democratic luminaries are automatically delegates so that they can protect the interests of the Democratic Party. And over the next several years, we evolved to the point of where we have what's dubbed superdelegates, but they're really unpledged delegates. They are the trustees of the Democratic Party, so-called. They are supposed to go to the convention, and they're supposed to keep the faith and the commitment and make sure that there are no ragtag nominees taking over the Democratic Party who've been influenced by all kinds of ways in which you can get yourself made a delegate in all these bizarre states and then do so on a schedule determined by the Democratic Party. So here we are with these so-called superdelegates, and that's all you're hearing about these days, because all of a sudden, this incredible experiment in democracy that we were so proud of, starting with the time period in Mississippi in 1964, and where we are now at 2008, where we have what we consider to be the ultimate. One half of the delegates must be women. Proportionally, the ethnic representation must reflect it. A certain percentage of the delegates must be young people. A certain percentage of delegates must be old people. I mean, we have so many ways to make sure that we are diverse in our convention, which also fuels the participation in the early voting process for pledge delegates. Now we vote for pledged delegates and unpledged delegates. The unpledged delegates are the Dianne Feinsteins of the world. The pledged delegates are the people like London Breed and others who get selected at the local level in their caucuses. London is pledged, Dianne is unpledged. All of a sudden, somebody has come forward that this great experiment appears to be one that might create some additional problems as we move forward. Because when we came up with this idea, we never thought the descendant of Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, would be at the stage, or Shirley Chisholm would be at the stage where suddenly you have an African-American who is really competitive for the presidential nomination. Likewise, we never figured when we were doing this configuration that there would be a woman. Because after all, in the history of the Democratic Party, there has never been an African-American president, vice president, nominee. There has never been a woman presidential nominee. One woman vice presidential nominee, Geraldine Ferraro, in 1984, right here in San Francisco. So all of our playing around with the rules did not increase the opportunity for people who had been denied that opportunity through all the process to participate. And lo and behold, Bill and Hillary gets married, wins the White House after six terms as governors of that little bitty state called Arkansas, and they proceed. When they leave the White House, driving a U-Haul, taking every gift that had been given to them, and they moved off. She decided to run for U.S. Senate in New York, and bad things happened to Giuliani. He had to pull out. Bad things happened to her other opponent. He pulled out. Suddenly, we got a new superstar called Hillary Clinton, who just may run for president. And women all over this nation became proud advocates, potentially. Little girls became proud advocates. And then lo and behold, a senator from Illinois, a junior senator, who had become a superstar in the minds of people because of his incredible presentation at the Democratic Convention in Boston, suddenly begins to make noises about running. He makes the announcement, and suddenly we've got two extraordinary, talented people among eight or nine also talented people, but not extraordinarily talented people necessarily. So we've got this wonderful contest. And the way in which the contest is organized, with the internet being what it is, and with the Democratic National Committee having set the time period when people could do things, all of a sudden, you got a sudden change in the movement. You've got increased participation by people who never participated before. You've got ethnic loyalty being demonstrated to Barack Obama like no other. And you've got incredible popularity of Hillary Clinton warping the method of her campaign and those who are advising her because they put her on a treadmill of inaugurations rather than on a ceremonial participation, but ultimate inaugurations, not contests. The Obama operation took the internet and did Google one better. They begin to make ordinary people believe they could have an influence on the presidency and increase their interest in participating to the extent that Obama is better financed than even George Bush ever was with all that Hal Burton money and all that business. Mr. Obama has done the impossible, so to speak. He's gotten ordinary people to use their credit card on a daily, monthly, and a weekly basis to give him $5, $10. He's got thousands, hundreds of thousands of people giving him money for no apparent reason other than their belief that this is going to give them some benefit. People make money, pay contributions. I'm always amused at the public, and particularly the public press, because when I raised money, and let's say somebody gave $10,000, the first thing they would say would, oh, Willie Brown, what do you think, what are you doing for that person? What do you think that person expects? What are you doing for that person? Well, you know, ask them about $25. I wish I could have had, you know, that same guy go find me enough people to give $10,000, but at $25 a pop, and I would never have had to answer those questions. Obama is in that position. He raised more money than anybody has ever raised in life, and nobody has said, what do they expect for the money that they're giving you, Mr. Obama, because the amount each are giving him is so small. That is incredible. Secondly, Mr. Obama has done the job of, like no other politician, he absolutely makes you believe you are personally talking to him every day. You got an email, and it says, hello, PJ. Well, last night we had a great victory in North Carolina, and it was because of those kinds of things that you've done. Or I'm going to be out in Oregon in another week or so, hope to see you. Well, PJ looks at it, and he thinks this guy has personally written him. But then he talks to his wife, Karen, and she got the same letter. But hers said, hi, Karen. So Obama has mastered the ability to communicate and to communicate personally and effectively. And as a result of that, his candidacy has launched him beyond Hillary's trip around the country, thanking people for giving her the presidency for which she would receive on the 21st of January. And it has become a real contest. A contest where suddenly you got an African-American leading and her second-place possible finisher is a white woman. That is a dramatic change in the political delivery system for the Democratic Party in this nation. And I just love to hear all these people on television, luminary Democrats on television saying Hillary Clinton should quit because this fight is killing the Democratic Party. Are you kidding me? This fight is making the Democratic Party. This fight is producing more people enthusiastic about politics than anybody has ever done. I simply cite when I'm on the air. When they start telling me about, well, it's divisive, it could be. I said, let me ask you, would you prefer the beautiful, orchestrated, lovely waltz of Al Gore and John Kerry going to the convention, already aligned, already unified, and getting their brains beaten out in each of the contests? Or do you prefer to have people scratching each other's eyes out as they go about trying to select a nominee, and with those fingernails still really sharp, continuing to scratch people's eyes out to win the presidency? I think I want the scratchers. I don't think I want the cats walking or in unison with each other, particularly two white males. Then they say, well, Obama gets the nomination. Well, should he take Hillary Clinton? Obama should take whomever he pleases. One of the scribes, smart lady, steps forward on television last night, and she says, I'm certain that he'll take Mr. Clark, Wesley Clark. So why would he do that? She said, well, military, foreign policy expert. Wait a minute, back up for a second. Isn't Obama about change? I said, yeah. Well, why in the hell would he be pulling out a dinosaur to brand his running mate? He ought to be taking somebody who has not yet been bred in any way. Don't you think that he ought to be looking at maybe a woman as his run? Oh, well, you're just pushing Hillary. No, I'm not just pushing Hillary, but I'm telling you, Hillary and Obama do represent change. They represent change because we have never been in the position we're in on this occasion when they have become the two people. And so, in this day and age, I am praying that somebody at the luminary level will begin to think Obama is doing his number because he represents change. Hillary is doing her number because she represents change. Each of them knocked out the remnants of Gore and Kerry in the form of Biden and Dodd and Richardson and John Edwards. They beat them. They beat them. So why is it that all of a sudden we're about to now say we've got to tailor a ticket reflective of how we tailored tickets for the last X number of years? No, we ought to tailor a ticket reflective of an incredible sea change in the process of this democracy. We ought to tailor a ticket that legitimately offers an alternative to John McBush and that whole operation that they are, in fact, putting together. And so, in the world of politics, it's a great time to be alive. It's a great time not to be a superdelegate. It's a great time. And I was for 20 years. The one time that I'm not a superdelegate is the only time it means anything. That shows you how really smart I am. But it is a great time for those of us who are interested in the world of politics. It is, for the very first time, an opportunity to allow creative thinking to be a part of the selection process, creative thinking to be a part of the contest. And last night, one of the scribes talked about how Mr. Obama, if he gets the nomination, Mr. McCain would prefer to run against Mr. Obama. I said, that is a code word for saying Mr. Obama's got a problem because he's black. Yes, race is an issue in this campaign. Race will be an issue in this campaign if Mr. Obama is the nominee. If Hillary Clinton is the nominee, gender will be an issue in the campaign, and you better recognize it and be clear. Gender is less offensive to the body politic and less suspect to the body politic than race. But it is still a 5% handicap. Race is probably a 10% handicap. So this particular scribe proceeds to say, well, that means Mr. Obama will have trouble winning Ohio. He'll then, Democrats need Ohio. Mr. Obama will have trouble winning Florida. Democrats need Florida. I said, you know, it's a tragedy. But you don't even understand that there's been a total change in how states may vote next time around. I have never in my life seen the occasion when Mississippi may vote Democratic. I wasn't even participating in politics when last time Mississippi voted Democratic. But because of Barack Obama's candidacy, all of a sudden, the dominant population in Mississippi could very well be African Americans and the few decent white people that they can influence. And that may cause Mississippi to go the same way North Carolina may go, the same way South Carolina may go, the same way Arkansas may go, the same way Louisiana may go. It is just mind-boggling to think of how the landscape will change. The blue states will no longer be necessarily blue, and the red states may be so influenced by black that they become purple. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible what could, in fact, occur this time around. Yet our superscribes on radio and television are not even thinking that way. They are so far behind where the people are. And the people really have moved on. The people rejected the traditional potential Democratic nominees and went for change. They went for either Hillary or they went for Obama. Each represent change from the normal selection process. That means then that each of them are going to have to be more creative than any of their predecessors. They're going to have to appeal to the body politic in a way dramatically different than anyone else has ever done in the past, which is what they have done in the primary. If I'm McCain, I would be frightened if either one of them would be my opponent, because I know as McCain, I am stuck with yesterday for political purposes. And I cannot get away from yesterday. All of what I've built is based on precedent. These two candidates are something different. They're not on precedent. Obama, the audacity of hope. Hillary Clinton, for the first time, the full equality of women, a release of all that incredible pent-up energy. It is so exciting. It is so different. And it is being watched by people all over the world. If you want to get a good slant on the news, skip the channels you've been watching here in San Francisco. And every day, the BBC has about, 10 or 15-minute analysis on our political scene around the presidential campaign. That is absolutely mind-boggling. And the same goes for almost every other country in the world. They are focused and riveted on the idea that for the first time, America may grant full equality to one or the other of the people that have never fully enjoyed equality by giving them the opportunity to lead this nation. I'm telling you, this is history. This is what people ought to be writing about. This is what people ought to be paying attention to. And this is what I am enjoying as much as I enjoyed the contents of all that stuff that's in my book. Thank you.
Our thanks to Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco and the author of the new autobiography, Basic Brown, My Life in Our Times, for his remarks today. I'm Joseph Fink. I'm the president of Dominican University in San Rafael, California, and I'm also the past president of the club's Board of Governors. More importantly, this evening, I'm the moderator for the question and answer session. Mr. Mayor, we have a large number of questions. Some about local politics, some about state politics, but mostly about national politics. Among this group of several hundred intimate friends and 2 million radio listeners, would you mind telling us who you're going to endorse for the election and the primary?
I'm going to write my name in.
Well...
I mentioned my ego earlier.
Well, thank you. thank you for assisting with that. You spoke a good deal about the superdelegates. Do they really have an important role to play, and should they continue to have an important role to play in Democratic politics from this point on?
Absolutely. They are the delegates who have been chosen through an electoral process where you elect Dianne Feinstein as a U.S. senator from California, Boxer as a senator from California, Pelosi as a congressperson, where you elect Villaraigosa as a mayor, Newsom as a mayor, where you elect people to state office like Bill Lockyer and people in that category. Those are the people who are the keepers of the faith for Democrats and for the Democratic Party. Their role is one of exercising good judgment when the opportunity presents itself, uncontrolled by any vote cast in any other locale. They are the real honorees of the party. Some are national committee people, and they should continue to play that role. That is a very valuable role, because you understand that in some states, people who are not Democrats can participate in selecting the Democratic nominee through the pledged delegate process, i.e., independents can vote in Democratic primaries, Republicans can vote in Democratic primaries, a decline to state can vote in Democratic primaries. Anybody can vote in a Democratic primary in some of these states. And in these caucus states, people are bused from other states to participate in the caucus process. So you got to have somewhere your private political party, your organization, like the Commonwealth Club, when they vote for you as the chair of the Board of Governors, they did not invite the League of Women Voters to come cast a vote. Only the members of the Commonwealth Club cast that vote. Superdelegates are only members of the Commonwealth Club, and they will continue to play that role, and they will cast their votes.
Thank you. A few years ago, you hosted a fundraising event for Barack Obama when he was getting ready to run for the United States Senate in Illinois. What drew you to him, and what drew you to support him at that early stage in his career?
I am part of a network of African-American office holders and luminaries around the country that for the last 30 or 40 years have been really working to expand the electoral opportunity of talented African-Americans of color. I must tell you, I'm also a contributor to Emily's List, which does the same kind of thing for women on the money side. In that regard, I got the call about this guy named Barack Obama from Illinois, who's going to run for the U.S. Senate and had a good chance of winning. I laughed. Nobody with the name Barack Obama is going to win anything, anywhere, at any time. That's too close to what we don't lack. And nobody's going to do that. Well, lo and behold, I agreed to take the call from him, and he told me the story. He said, they told me you said nobody named Barack Obama is going to win anything. I want to prove to you differently. And he came out here. He was a charming young man. We raised a lot of money for him. We were the first people ever to raise money in California for Barack Obama. And the results were that he won in Illinois because he's got the same little God Barbara Boxer has. Barbara Boxer's got a little God that just messes over anybody who runs against her. Obama has got that same little God. No matter how talented you think you are, the guards really screw over you if you run against one of their spoken persons. And Obama was in that category. Three Democrats, all with money, better names, and what have you. In the primary, each one of them had a problem of some sort that caused them to lose dramatically. And then a guy named Ryan was the Republican nominee. He was going to be one day a candidate for the president on a Republican side until his wife got unsealed their divorce papers, and it turns out that he had been using his wife as a lap dancer to improve the quality of his business, and he'd been abusive to her in other ways and didn't think she was a fit mother, and he ended up having to resign because the Republicans didn't want anything to do with a cat that did not have anything to do with family values, just the opposite of family values. And they were so desperate for a candidate, they selected a black guy from Maryland named Alan Keyes to run in Illinois against Obama. Mr. Keyes had one little problem. He said he wouldn't move to Illinois until he had won. So he was never in Illinois. Now, you tell me the little god of Boxer didn't visit itself upon Obama. Obama wins. Makes a liar out of me, a person who can't predict anything from anybody, obviously, with any degree of accuracy.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, our radio audience, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest today is the former San Francisco mayor and political commentator, Willie Brown. Mr. Mayor, this question that came up is a little surprise to me. I haven't been paying attention to news during the course of the day, but this questioner claims that both Dianne Feinstein and George McGovern have switched their allegiance from Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama. Well, let me ask the audience, has anyone else heard that? Feinstein? Oh, all right. Well, never mind the question, Mr. Mayor, since we've straightened that out. Let's talk a little bit more about Mr. Obama. How do you think he handled the Reverend Wright incident that was played up so heavily in the press?
Well, he was slow, real slow. Initially, Barack said that he wasn't present when the speech was made. I called his operation totally alarmed, said, you've been there 20 years. You're going to be made to look really like a terrible liar if you say you were not present, because that was not the first time your pastor has made remarks like that. He went back to the drawing boards and, in fact, proceeded to say in his great speech in Philadelphia that the issue on race, et cetera, et cetera. But he also added two or three lines that probably should not have been in the speech, and that is that he could no more reject his pastor and his spiritual advisor than he could reject his grandmother. Well, give me a break. You selected your spiritual advisor. Your grandmother got you. She selected you. So you don't, there's a difference in the rejection process. And so that was a mistake. He never should have said, because after all, his book, The Audacity of Hope, is the title of a sermon from Reverend Wright, from Jeremiah Wright. And his children were baptized by Wright. He was married to his wife by Wright. And there's been a close relationship. He should have said, when he announced he was running, and when he asked Wright to not come do the invocation at his announcement in Springfield, he was conscious, obviously at that moment, that Wright was a potential problem. We politicians do have instincts, and he was conscious that Wright might be a problem. Well, none of us knew that Wright was as much of a problem, potentially, as Obama should have known. And at the time that he did his number on the announcement, that's the day he should have said, and in my making this announcement, I am breaking with my spiritual advisor and my pastor, who's got a different view about America, a view I don't share. And I'm running to remove people like him and the things that he represents from influencing the body politic. It's a painful separation, but I want to have nothing to do with Jeremiah Wright. And as a matter of fact, I bought him a ticket to Rwanda. Then he wouldn't have had to make any of the speeches. Fox News wouldn't have had. So his timing was just terrible. I mean, just terrible. He ultimately did become angry enough to say the things that I just essentially said. But it was a year and 2 months after he had said, please don't do the invocation. Now, you tell me if that isn't slow. I don't know what is slow.
Thank you. Until a few months ago, President Bill Clinton was admired as one of the most astute politicians that the United States had ever seen, and certainly within the Democratic Party. But in the last few months, he's been vilified as, in some ways, a detriment to Hillary's campaign. What's your view on that?
First and foremost, the assessment of Bill Clinton's skills was not mistaken. Those skills still exist. They are reposed now, however, in a human being that is absolutely emotionally desperate to help a relative, in this case, a wife, whom he genuinely believes is more than qualified to be the president. He cares enough about her, and he cares enough about the nation to not do the kind of normal assessments that we politicians occasionally do. And he has allowed himself the luxury of being quoted when he shouldn't have been opening his mouth. And that has created, in some cases, a problem for Hillary. But we politicians are funny. I'm sure glad somebody said, turn off the cell phones. Because I was at a place where a lady introduced me. She said, he's going to talk about politics, but he would really want each one of us to check our cell phones. She said, he said to me, you can keep your gun, but you must give up your cell phone. Because he doesn't want you text messaging what he said out of the room. Well, Bill Clinton obviously has not arrived at the electronic age sufficiently, and now, for that matter, is Hillary, because, ducking sniper fire in Bosnia was not part of the deal that she should have been talking about. Could have gotten away with it if she was in Arkansas running, and people in Arkansas don't watch television too much, and the results was there, but Bill Clinton has not been as helpful as his stature, his ability, and his skill, because Bill Clinton suffered the same way and perception that many of us have of how he was not used by Al Gore. Al Gore didn't want anything to do with Bill Clinton. He thought Bill Clinton would hurt his campaign. I think there were Hillary staff people who started Hillary's campaign keeping Bill Clinton out because it was a walk in the park, and they didn't want the Clinton, Bill Clinton baggage. Not until she started to get in trouble did she do what we all do, and that's call upon the people you trust the most. And so he was fighting two battles. He was fighting the battle of arriving at the request of a wife who was becoming desperate, and he was arriving at a time dealing with a collection of staff people who didn't want him around, and he knew that they did not want him around. The Clinton machine did not run Hillary Clinton's campaign. If the Clinton machine had been running Hillary's campaign, you would have seen Jim Carville first and foremost out of the box participating in every step she made. And that's what Bill Clinton would have had James do. But Clinton was not running that campaign. He was handicapped to being a spokesperson. And he misread the reaction of African Americans. He didn't understand that the race pride associated with what prompted all of us to become Brooklyn Dodger fans was available for an African-American who would become a viable candidate for the presidency. And when Obama convinced white people that they should look at him for his qualifications first before they looked at his blackness, black people did not buy what some people tried to say, and that is Obama wasn't black enough. They said that because Obama ran against a black congressman and lost 75 to 25 or some other number, and it was bad rap. But Obama and his campaign knew that African Americans would eventually kick in great numbers. Bill and Hillary, who were much closer to African Americans than Obama, didn't understand that the brothers and the sisters, when they get the chance to do something unprecedented that's never been done, no matter what their relationship is with their white friends, they're probably going to end up with the brother or with the sister. Bill didn't understand that, and it really hurt him when John Lewis and people like that, that he'd been with for years, defected and went for the black guy, who incidentally never asked for their support, never spoke at one of their meetings seeking their support, and never said one word about what he was going to do specifically with reference to African Americans. And that's because Clinton didn't understand there was no need to do that. The race pride was there. And a combination of all these things has caused Bill Clinton's reputation to become suspect.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, you're an experienced politician. How important is experience in exceeding and succeeding in office? Richard Nixon was more experienced than John Kennedy. Most historians believe John Kennedy was a better president. George Bush was less experienced than Al Gore, and Mr. Bush is not getting very high marks as president. How important is experience in being the president or succeeding in office?
Experience is highly overrated. You're better off if you demonstrate your skill and ability to handle complex issues and to do so in a manner in which the most simple among us can understand that you've handled that issue. Then the word on experience goes right out the window, period. Because when you say experience and you don't really say what that means in terms of your skill and your ability, you're better off discussing your skill and ability and leaving the word experience out.
Okay, thank you. This is an area you've touched on before or earlier in your talk, but perhaps it deserves a little more comment. Gloria Steinem has said that America is more sexist than racist. What do you think of that comment?
She's wrong.
Would you like to add anything to that?
Speaks for itself.
All right. Moving right along, if you were advising Hillary Clinton now, as a personal advisor to her and her campaign, as opposed to an objective person that you are, as you have been, would you be asking her or advising her to drop from the race since the mathematical ability of her succeeding is rather quite slim right now?
No, I would not.
Okay. Thank you. Well, let's move
now,
on.
You want to know why?
Sure, yes, tell me.
Well, yes, no, I would not.
Tell me why. Okay.
If I had 1,696 or 97 delegates pledged to my campaign and to my candidacy, I would do exactly what I did with the 1,400 in 88 that we had for Jesse Jackson. We did not give up Jackson's quest for the nomination until I stepped on the podium in Atlanta, Georgia, and said, we second the nomination of Dukakis. Because you see, what prompted me to step up there and say that is that we got a commitment from the Democratic Party that Ron Brown would be the chair of the party. We got a commitment from the Democratic Party that Maynard Jackson would head the voter registration operation for the Democratic Party. We got a series of commitments about memberships on committees of the Democratic National Committee, representation on the National Committee, and a promise if victory was achieved by the Democrats in the fall, the cabinet would be sprinkled with recommendations we made, some African Americans and some not African Americans. You don't get anything for just announcing that you're quitting. Hillary is going to be needed in the fall for Obama if Obama is the nominee. After all, almost half of the Democrats in this nation are for Hillary Clinton, period. That is worth something. And before she makes any announcement, if she is inclined to so do, I would hope she has negotiated maybe who goes on the ticket second. Doesn't have to be her, but certainly not Wesley Clark. Who goes, could be that she becomes Secretary of State. There are all kinds of things that 1,690-plus delegates ought to entitle you to in helping to shape the mission of this party in responding to the needs of this nation. It could be she gets the opportunity to be the architect of the universal health care application of the Democratic Party. Or she gets the opportunity to, in fact, tax the oil companies instead of us paying the taxes. There are a whole series of things beyond my kind of trite personal deal of who gets appointed to what. There are some substantive issues that should be the subject matter of any given up. That nomination is the most coveted item there is, because I'm telling you, the Democrats are going to beat John McCain. They are going to defeat the Republican machine. That means Democrats are going to be the presidency. And if I'm part of the architects that produce that, I am definitely going to be part of how we distribute the goodies that come from it.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest today is former San Francisco mayor and political commentator Willie Brown. Mayor Brown, what are your thoughts about the seating of the delegates from Florida and Michigan?
I have said repeatedly that the states of Michigan and the states of Florida had nothing whatsoever to do with, as Democrats, when their elections are held. The Democratic Party, under the leadership of the current head of the party, Howard Dean, cannot dictate to states when you hold your election. That's done by the legislature and the governor of those states. Therefore, the Democratic Party in those states should not be punished by not being allowed to participate in the election and the selection process when the party meets in the convention. The Democratic Party knew a year ago that Florida and Michigan was on a calendar unacceptable to the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party should have said at that time, not that you won't be seated, but you won't be seated from the results of that election. You hold a convention like Democrats just held in San Jose less than a month ago, and at that convention, you elect delegates, pledged or unpledged, we don't care which, and those will be the delegates that will be seated no matter what the results are from that election that we think should not occur. But the Democratic Party didn't do that. So now the Democratic Party is embarrassingly in a position where they don't know what to do. What should they do? It's very simple. Both names were on the ballot in Florida. Neither campaigned in Florida. Each got a certain number of the delegates in Florida. Seat those delegations. In Michigan, one name was on the ballot, put on there by friends and relatives of hers. There were 53 of the total number of delegates who were not committed to anything and not on anybody's ballot. Seat those 53 uncommitted delegates instantly because they are not for whomever. And then said Obama and Clinton, Clinton, we're giving you 15 more in Michigan than Obama has. Negotiated down to 10 and accepted. And that'll be a good verdict because Obama will be incredibly unhappy and Hillary will be incredibly unhappy, but the delegates will be seated and that formula will have nothing to do with who becomes the nominee.
Thank you. We've spent most of our time together talking about the national elections, and we have a few minutes left, so let's talk a little bit about state and local politics, and let's look back into your history as well. Which of the governors that you worked with was the governor you admired most, and why was that?
Jerry Brown.
And why was that?
Because he took every recommendation I ever made.
How do you feel? How do you feel our present governor is doing, especially with all of the discussions about the looming larger and larger and larger state deficit?
He has a real problem. Term limits, has robbed the legislature of the ability to build relationships that will allow for a reaching of a consensus without reference to party control. The legislature is totally now in the hands of Democrats on one side and Republicans on the other, and nobody in between. They don't talk to each other. They don't cooperate with each other. They don't have among them a majority who has a sense that there is a purpose for being here higher than getting elected. Each of them are burdened with that horror. On the other hand, you got a governor who got elected without any political party. And as a result of that, he conducts himself as if he is without any political party. And that gets you nowhere, period. And so the results are the state's in a disaster shape. He's my buddy. The head of the legislature is my buddy. And I'm doing everything I can to try to convince them that they just ought to make some kind of a deal to settle the issue, as Pete Wilson did with me in 1992.
Thank you. Last year, you did some analysis of local politics as well when we had this speech. And at that time, you were, lukewarm to the performance of our mayor, Gavin Newsom. How do you feel today after a year?
He's still struggling, and he's struggling because he doesn't have a board of supervisors with a sufficient number of members who are really interested in doing anything except annoying him without reference to public policy. And that's too bad because, again, you have basically a dysfunctional government, and you have a man whom I appointed whose skill set doesn't fit the dysfunctional situation. You know, some people that work very well in dysfunctional situation. He doesn't. And he is not interested, I don't think, enough in making the sacrifices and risk than the political capital to try to change that. He is, however, going to benefit because the public is pretty disgusted with the current Board of Supervisors in many respects. I think the public is aware that they have an opportunity in district, in all the odd number of districts this year, to elect some good people. And there are some good people running. Sue Lee is running to replace McGoldrick. Claudine Ching is running to replace Peskin. Or you've got a guy whom I don't have a great amount of a relationship with because he's part of Gonzalez's operation, or running Randy Knox running out to replace Sandoval. You've got only districts in which people who are running may not work out is that District Amiano is leaving. But almost every other district is having somebody who's got a better sense that they are not just district representatives. They run from districts, but they are city representatives. Our board is plagued with district-itis. Each of the members of that board, or many members of that board, have no sense that any decision they make is a decision that affects the whole city. They really think it affects only the little space that Chris Daley controls, or they think it represents the little space that Sophie Maxwell controls. It's too bad that we don't have the people who are elected from districts like a Barbara Kaufman or Kevin Shelley or Leslie Katz. They had a city sense in mind. And so Gavin Newsom suffers from the absence of a board of supervisors that has district skills, district interests, and district agendas, plus annoying him. And for some people, it may be the only way to keep his sanity is to stay out of town.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, unfortunately, we reached the point in the program where there's time for only one last question. Your book was extraordinarily interesting and entertaining as well. Is there going to be a sequel? And are you going to tell some of the secrets that you've held back? And would you mind telling us one now before we finish?
Well, I am intrigued about the possibility of doing another book. Simon and Schuster is kind of intrigued because the book is selling enough. They're into the second printing, and it's moving along reasonably well. My next book, unlike the current book, will be totally fiction. And so current book is only partially fictional. So it will be a book it'll have more sauce in it. I will discuss my conversation on the train with Elliot's lady, whom I didn't know was Elliot's lady when I was on the train with her. I will discuss the day that I met Larry Craig and noticed the handshake and the foot kick that didn't work. I'm going to talk about all those things when I do it. So Sex and Scandal will be the hallmark of my next production, because I want to be able to sell a lot more books at the Commonwealth Club.
Our thanks to Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco and author of the new autobiography, Basic Brown, My Life and Our Times, for his remarks today. We also wish to thank our audiences here in person and on radio and television. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.